Bros. I'm Brad Patton. Today we welcome Tom Holzing and Zach Wheeler from Howling Giant to the podcast. Howling Giant's new record, Crucible and Ruin, is out this Friday on Magnetic Eye Records. The guys talk about embracing musical simplicity with doom metal, the journey that eventually got them signed to Magnetic Eye, the lore behind Crucible and Ruin, creating video games to accompany albums, and so much more. Thanks so much for checking out this episode of As the Story Grows. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. You can find links in our show notes or at asthestorygrows.com for our Discord server, our mailing list, and our Patreon page, where $1 a month will get you early access to every episode. You could also leave the podcast a comment, like Christopher Martinez 2548 did over on YouTube for Chapter 657 with Darius and Alex from Spite. He said, "This is dope. Thanks for this." You're welcome. If you like what you hear, leave a comment. I would love to read it on the podcast. Enjoy today's episode with Tom and Zach from Howling Giant.
That's been our rehearsal space this summer, where it's just it locks in, and I'll get air in there, but man, it was getting gnarly when it's like 100 degrees here in Nashville, like
it seems like we're slowly winding down the super hot temperature, and I hope so, but
fingers crossed.
Well, how are you guys both originally from Nashville, or are you transplants to the city?
Transplants. We've been here since 2013, though. Tom and I met in college up in Boston. Before that, I was an army brat, so we moved around every 2 years. So, but my family's like South Central Pennsylvania.
Cool. What about you, Tom? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, man, I'm from Minnesota, so I grew up in just kind of northwest of the Twin Cities. So grew up there, met Zach in Boston. I honestly had a great time out there. Northeast was awesome. But Nashville's been great since 2013. So
that's awesome. What took you guys to Boston for college?
We both went to music college. So we went up there basically to study different areas of the music industry. I went into guitar performance, which in hindsight is like, I don't know that you need to go to college for, you know, guitar performance. But as a young man, it seemed like the correct choice of career, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what brought me. And I know, Zach, you studied some more like music business and pro music kind of stuff.
Yeah, I did music business. I went in thinking that I was going to do a lot more production stuff. I was interested in like the studio thing. And then it didn't vibe with me, because you kind of can test some stuff out in the first year before you're really picking a major. And I was like, this is fine. But like, you know, I thought about video game music. We've got some friends that are working in that industry now, which is super cool. But again, I didn't like the thought of just kind of locking down in a studio 24/7 for the job. So getting involved with the music business side of things was nice, because I feel like I could apply it to my bands, you know, and get out there because I liked playing, you know?
Yeah. So I went to a school specifically for recording in 2002, 2003. And it was like, as soon as I graduated, basically digital exploded and everything I learned doesn't matter anymore. Do you kind of feel the same with your music business? Like, everything they taught me is bullshit now.
Yeah. I mean, the continuing education is just one of those things in this industry. I mean, well, any industry, right? I had professors that were like, they managed the rock band Boston, and like people like that were like, they would talk about their experiences in the 70s and 80s and stuff. And they're like, but not all of this really applies today, because we were in school like 2009, 2013. And it was, I mean, a totally different landscape with the digital explosion and everything else. And I think that while they didn't necessarily teach like this is exactly how you do it. It's more of the like here's things to keep an eye on. Everything's going to be shifting. You'll need to network. Like the thing that does not expire is the ability to network, and like that's the thing that they were really driving home at school for all of us, performance, business, whatever it is. And then just learning through the experience of it. Well, I think I learned probably a lot more personally getting out on the road with this band pretty quickly. You know, we make our mistakes, we figure out what happens. But at least like professionally, it was nice to have some mentors and stuff to like, at least like, you know, teach you the basics of all this stuff.
Yeah.
No one teaches you how to like do your taxes as a freelance musician, but like that sort of stuff was like nice to have from some of these guys. You know, they're like, hey, don't forget, you're going to owe a ton of money because you don't pay taxes during your paycheck, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the first real kick when I like went freelance and had a studio, and it was like, oh shit,
my life is over in February. Yeah.
It was great. It was great. Well, let's go back in time. What got each of you into music?
Yeah, I got into, I guess I started playing on classical guitar when I was like a kid. So I remember just being like a really little guy and being like, I want to like play rock guitar. I think I saw, I don't remember what it was, but I think I have a vague memory of like seeing Kermit the Frog holding like a star-shaped guitar when I was like just so small. And my parents were like, all right, we should start him out on the right track. So they started me in this like classical guitar journey, which I kind of went through all of high school. And that was cool. I learned a ton, but more than anything, I think there was this like, you know, need to like step away from something so like strict and formal that classical guitar was. I mean, I attribute so much of my like skill set and work ethic to that classical guitar stuff, but so much of like what I'm interested in was like a direct act of rebellion to that. You know, the classical like guitar scene is like so, you know, you kind of get trained to compete. And when you're competing, everything has to be like a very specific, you know, interpretation of the piece of music, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think getting into like, at the time, I was in a garage band with some buddies of mine. We did like just a lot of punk kind of stuff. And that was like awesome because it was, you know, so much more in a lot of ways rudimentary and just like glorifying just being loud and obnoxious, which was like, that's perfect. And in a lot of ways, I think Howling Giant and just like stoner rock and doom is like an extension of that core set, you know, just
I mean, that's how we started. Yeah, is like we were learning all these like, you know, advanced techniques in school there, and then this was the band that we wrote stoner riffs and wrote about our Dungeons and Dragons campaigns. We're like, throw that stuff out. This one is just a riff to slam to.
It's interesting though. It's like you learn so much, and then you learn how powerful the simple stuff is. It's like you know, being in college and learning classical guitar for me is like, you know, I went so deep on this stuff, and I'm realizing like the stuff I use live is like 20% of what this is. And it's so important. Like, how do you connect with an audience? What do people actually like love to hear and jam to? And a lot of times it's like kind of more simple in a lot of ways. So, you know, not that it was a waste to learn all this kind of in-depth stuff in college, but you learn really quick, like, what do I need to be effective on the road with a real band at a show in front of real people? And it's a different skill set entirely.
And how do you
playing zeros, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Kind of that, man. I mean, fast and loud pleases the crowd, you know? Yeah. That's it.
What about you, Zach?
Yeah, my grandma taught piano lessons, and I kind of just like, she kind of really shared the love of music there, but I didn't really get in anything like formal until like probably seventh grade. I joined the concert band, and immediately I was like, I would like to play percussion. And they would not let anyone play percussion until you put in 6 months with some other instrument. So I played trumpet for a little bit. I paid my dues and got back in the percussion section. And then, it was a lot of like, you know, high school. I was in North Carolina. So marching band, the drumline stuff was huge. So I did a lot of that. And then my buddy Miles, just shredding guitarist, was going up to Berkeley for school, and he was like, you should see if you can kind of transfer some of these drumline and symphonic percussion skills over to drum set. So I like got a drum set, figured out how to play. We were covering like all the metalcore stuff that was around back then, you know, Killswitch Engage and like Avenged Sevenfold. And that like I was late to the drum set, but I had like fundamentals to lead to that. And Miles kind of helped me along, like, all right, this is how I can put all that together. You know, the coordination still is nuts because obviously drumline, it's all hands. So like starting to involve your legs and stuff was brain breaking at the time.
Well, then how do you two meet, and how does that kind of become Howling Giant?
Yeah, we were both in different bands in college. So I was in a like prog rock band at the time with some friends, and it was, you know, we were exploring some real pretentious territory. You know what I mean? We were worshiping at the altar of Dream Theater kind of stuff and just trying to shred. And that was really cool. I loved that band. It was awesome. But I think at a certain point, it was like, what's the most fun? And for me at the time, it was like the Sword is what I wanted to really play like. I was like, I honestly just want to listen to Age of Winters and just like play those riffs. Those just hit better. And Zach, I know, had a similar story with a different band in college.
I mean, we just, it was all about like not necessarily prog, but like thrashier stuff and like a little more technical. But then it was just like, yeah, I mean, the Sword, our buddy Roger at the time was showing us like Weed Eater and stuff like that. And we're like, this is rad because these people are having fun, where like sometimes the prog and like more technical crowds, the entire audience will sit there just arms crossed staring and there's no movement. It's like, is anyone enjoying this show?
Well, and also when it comes to more technical stuff, it's almost like the music aspect is like secondary to like how hard the music is you're creating. There's like a need to make something difficult for the sake of, you know, impressing your peers who are in that genre. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like that produces, you know, kind of the worst music a lot of the times, you know what I mean? So getting to a project that almost glorifies the like simple and try to worship the vibe, you know, the volume and the feel of something. And so at the time we were called Skulldozer is the name of that project me and Zach started. So we were Skulldozer writing songs about Dungeons and Dragons, and it was awesome.
One show a year on April 20th.
At the Elks Lodge in Cambridge.
It. That's right.
And just crushing peavers and ripping, dude. It was the best. So I think it was like, man, we did that band kind of as a goof. We played the show just because we were like, this is sick. We got to play this for our friends. And then I think playing the live show, we realized like, this is actually awesome though. We should pursue this route. And so I think pretty quickly, at least my other band started to kind of drift away. And my focus kind of became this sort of area.
Right as we were graduating too. So we all moved down to Nashville, or three of the four of us did. Our other buddy, Noel, the other guitarist, ended up going over to LA, but we still see him every once in a while. He's out there just hired gunning. Tom, Roger, and I moved down to Nashville with our friends and just started, we kind of rebranded as Howling Giant and, started making the EPs and now we're here. And I think also it's like kind of worth noting, we found a way to start infusing some of these prog aspects that we love from like the other bands. Like we kind of stripped everything down and kept it simple. And now we're finding like the acceptable level of like, you know, this isn't progressive for progressive sake. It's progressive because it suits the song or something like that. We could infuse some of that technical ability because it's a cool part. And if you put something crazy next to something simple, each part hits so much harder.
Well, and I think there's a lot of prog that I love and that I know Zach loves. And so it's finding like, what do we like about this beyond just like, you know, as athletes what's difficult about the playing of this, what's like musically awesome. And I think starting out as Skulldozer with the simplified like bass and foundation was kind of a cool route to get back to some prog elements to be like, you know, now that we've established the simple core, what can really bring that to the next level with just kind of carefully chosen moments of like prog.
Right. And before you know it, I'm getting scoffed at by the sound guy again because I am bringing three rack toms to the show.
He had a good rule, though. He had a great rule in the studio. He was like, if you don't use it, I'm taking it away.
If you don't hit it on this take, it's gone.
So Zach had to use, if you're going to bring the giant kit, you got to use the whole thing. That was awesome.
Yeah.
It was good.
That's funny. Yeah. It would almost to me seem a little counterintuitive from a maybe metal band perspective to move from Boston and the New England scene to Nashville. Was the move to Nashville more just like other musical career stuff, so that makes more sense outside of the band?
I think it was like we had a bunch of friends who were moving down here with a game plan. And I know at least for me, it was like, well, I don't really have a game plan, but I know that I'm not ready to go back to Minnesota quite yet. So how about...
Another driving force was that we were broke and Boston is expensive to live in. And we were like, well, do we move out in the boonies of Massachusetts somewhere and try to like, you know, the metalcore scene was always huge up there. All those bands. But we really didn't fit that. We were also kind of thinking like Nashville is so centrally located when we're starting a career as a band. We're just kind of like, you're going to do weekend tours. And you can hit so many more spots from Nashville than you could in the New England area. You kind of get stuck almost. So, I mean, that was a factor. We were also like, you know, like I said, I studied music business. My girlfriend at the time, wife now, is in audio. She does like live front of house and monitors and stuff. So that was another consideration for me. It's like, oh, Nashville is the hub for this sort of work. So,
It's interesting to hear you say like you don't fit, but like listening to the new record feels so much like Cave In to me. I don't know if that's a weird comparison, but I'm just like
I hear that
influence. Maybe it's not even influence, maybe it's happenstance, but I'm like, yeah.
we love Cave In, and I think what I really love about what they're doing is they're bringing kind of like, I feel they're bringing like a modern take on a lot of this, like, you know, not to say they were necessarily stoner rock, but like somewhere in this umbrella of like, you know, where post rock meets psych meets like stoner doom or whatever. Cave In kind of just became a thing. And I feel like just modernized and brought this really like fresh. And so I think like, man, I admire that approach. And I think that's something we want to do is how can we be a band similar to Cave In, not stylistically, but with that approach of like, let's bring and push this genre into kind of a new corner, you know? They're awesome. I love them quite a bit.
That's cool. How'd you guys get connected with Magnetic Eye?
A while ago, Jad hit us up about the Pink Floyd Redux they were doing when they redid The Wall. And that was already filled up, but he was asking if we wanted to be on the bonus disc. And he was like, pretty much any other Pink Floyd track, here's what's taken. Obviously, you can't do anything on The Wall. And we hit him back with Matilda Mother, and he was just like, what? And we were like, yeah, trust us. And we put a spin on that cover, and then we he had just been a fan for a little bit, and like he pitched us to Psycho Las Vegas, and we got to go meet him out there finally. And just over the years, yeah, I mean, Jad is a great guy. And we just kept chatting. So he actually owns and operates Blues Funeral Recordings, who did our first full-length record as well. But basically just over the years, just keep on seeing this guy hanging out, doing ridiculous covers.
It's interesting how like in the early days, Magnetic Eye started as like a Boston label back when it was owned by Mike Vitale.
Yeah, even though he was like upstate New York guy, like it was like,
but I think he also went to, I think he went to Berkeley as well. So I think it was like, even though he was living up there, I think it was considered like, you know, Boston. At least that's the way I thought it was. Maybe it's just all his bands were living there.
Yeah.
But there was like a clear, like, okay, this label is pretty dope. Like, not a lot of bands that maybe I knew, but like really cool sounds and definitely in that heavy kind of corner of things. So I think early on, I remember back when we were Skulldozer saying to Zach, like, dude, we got to get on Magnetic Eye Records along with these other bands. And then Magnetic Eye became something like way different and like really sick, more in line with what we're doing now than it even was back then. It's just interesting how we had that drive to be on that label and then just years later finally getting there. And it was, I think, the right fit, the right move for us.
New album's called Crucible and Ruin. When I listened to your back catalog, obviously this is a huge sonic improvement from the EPs, but even from the last record, like, it seems like a big step was taken sonically and in the songwriting. Was that kind of an intentional decision of like, okay, how do we make the best thing possible? I think you always want to put your best foot forward, but was there like something that changed between the last record and this record?
I mean, I think leading up to this record, like, we've always just been DIY till we die kind of thing. We did everything ourselves from our practice space studio that mostly Zach built, but we all chipped in and kind of built together. So Glass Future, I think it was awesome. And I think it sounded great with us just using what we had available with our budget, which was like $0. So with that context, it's like, man, really proud of it. And also Kim Wheeler, Zach's wife, who mixed and recorded us on that, did just an amazing job, I think, with what we had access to for Glass Future. So I hold
All budget mics in a basement. You know, it's just like doing the best we can out there. The fact that she created what she did with what we gave her for tracks is like kind of crazy.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So I mean, I have a really special place in my heart for Glass Future, and especially the songwriting for it, I think, was awesome. That being said, it was definitely a focus of ours to say, let's upgrade the sound, at least with like the quality of tools and gear we have access to. So we kind of started looking around for ourselves, and we discovered Neil Turry of Amish Electric Chair Studios through our friends in Horseburner, who's another fantastic band that everyone should check out if you're not familiar. Horseburner. But we listened to their latest record in our van, and it just sounded so clear and just so punchy and so awesome in our van, which notoriously sounds like ass. So we were like, if it can sound good here, like, we need to reach out and just talk to this guy. So, you know, through them, we reached out to Neil and just had some conversations. And I think he was so in line from the first step with, you know, what we wanted to do, in what ways did we want to level up, and how could he help us get there? So I think that was really what catapulted that venture for us.
Crucible and Ruin, where'd this title come from, and what was kind of the inspiration behind this album?
So the original like working title for the record was Lesser Gods, and it was this focus on kind of creating a world that maybe wasn't built by like an omnipotent, all-knowing like being. We wanted to be like, what if there was like a novice world builder, this Archon character who just like
a dude going to work,
just you know? Like trying their hand at creating a world with no ultimate game plan, and, you know, creating worlds and scrapping them and trying again and reusing parts and, you know, living in this space that isn't like upheld by a grand design or a grand plan. So we kind of started putting together this concept and ultimately created like four perspectives for the record. One is the novice world builder. One is the like chaos element. This is almost like a primordial, like entropic sort of, I don't even know if you'd say creature or not, but it's a, like an entropic being. And that's represented by Beholder 1 and 2 on the record. Then the perspective of the people, the actual creation of this novice world builder. And the last perspective is essentially like the Watcher or the Archivist, which is kind of like a separate entity that just watches everything unfold and just documents and files it away in this like infinite library. And so we kind of created that story, that like subset of perspectives to categorize all the songs into. And really it was, I think, Zach who came up with the title Crucible and Ruin, which I think was a really cool way to bring up the idea of this like creation and destruction
cycle, almost. Yeah,
almost a cycle for this space. And it sounded very like, you know, not fairy tale, but
yeah,
you know. Yeah, so that's kind of how that came together.
Nice. You mentioned when you first started kind of writing riffs together, the like backdrop was like taking D&D campaigns and making songs out of them. Because that's a part of your background and a hobby, is that like always in your head where you're like this like notepad of ideas for songs, and you like that kind of more than just like pulling from personal bullshit? Or is it like anytime you got to write a record, it's like, fuck, now I gotta create something interesting now?
Yeah, I mean, lyrically, we've had a lot of help from our good friend James Sanderson, and he's helped us with like breakthroughs, I think, where like we were only writing about like all fantasy at points. Yeah. And I think probably around the time of Space Between Worlds, Glass Future, like writing those, we started to try to tie in some life experience and personal experience. And we're like, oh, I had this thing, you know, it not necessarily super deep. I remember the first one, one of the first ones, Tom, we were talking about the orb and you were talking about a childhood nightmare, or not the orb.
It was the orb. Yeah. Was a reoccurring nightmare that I had had for like years as a child. And it was like creating the vessel for that. Which I think is what the fiction became, you know,
right?
Yeah.
This kind of fantasy element we had always done was like, you know, instead of either just writing fantasy that was just shallow or just writing about your feelings and just making it blunt and emotional, it's like, how can the fantasy become like the vehicle for that real emotion?
Bands like Mastodon, Coheed and Cambria kind of do this all the time, where there's a bit of double meaning in some of this. So we've been like, we've been making a concerted effort to just kind of get into that a little bit more, because I feel like you come up with almost cooler and more unique ideas that way, like getting into some of your own experience. And that's been an interesting lyrical journey, because when we started this band, we were just like, well, we got to get a singer because none of us can do that. And none of us know how to write lyrics. And, you know, I think just through necessity, we've just been practicing how to sing, how to write lyrics, and grabbing every opportunity to learn something new.
That's cool. Susan Davies did the artwork. Is this a piece that was already done and you just bought, or is this something you commissioned?
No, this, so Susan M. Davies is my mom. So we got the hookup there, which is great.
Thanks, Mom.
She did this piece for us after, you know, we had been discussing what the album was about, some of the imagery we wanted to be represented on the cover based off of our like lyrical context, and the song's context. So we just had a lot of conversations and just basically over a few revisions dialed it into what this is now, which I think is a great representation of, you know, kind of the snapshot of feelings and imagery that we have on this record.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. It's giving very Lord of the Rings, fairy dark fairy tale vibes, which is cool.
Let's go. That's it. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Album's out on Halloween. That's cool. You guys are hitting the road in November. I saw you're just coming to Baltimore. I was looking at tour dates. That's make note of that. What's your plan outside of touring? Is it just to hit that run and then see what the new year brings?
We're already working on next year for booking. So unfortunately, earlier this year, we were supposed to go out, do a West Coast run June, July with Domcraft from Sweden. They had to cancel due to some health issues. So we are going to reschedule the tour, at least for us. We're going to go head out west like March, April. So we can hit, like, you know, hit all the West Coast markets around the new record, because basically November's a lot of East Coast stuff.
Yeah.
Looking towards Europe again. It's been a while since we've been over, which was October 2023 with Heavy Temple. So we're plotting that currently. And then, you know, just kind of getting back into writing mode for another record, because the cycle starts up quicker than you think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The promotion and writing and recording takes forever.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. By the time the record's out, it's, you're sick of it.
Yeah.
Last thing I had to ask before I let you guys go is the Comet Rider video game on your website. Whose idea was that to have a video game on the site?
Man, that was like, I think that was just a cool idea we had initially, brainstorming like almost PR campaigns for like, yeah, what do we want to do that can help the song? And my brother was going into like some animation kind of stuff and was mm-hmm. like, hey, I could maybe make, like, just out of the blue, was like, I could maybe make this like 8-bit kind of just like really rudimentary video game for our song Wailord at the time. So I think that put the thought in our head that we eventually opened up when we had the music video made and kind of were like, yeah, let's make a companion like nice game.
Yeah. And when the guy who did that video, the Comet Rider music video, Jackson Miller, when he got everything done, he was like, I do have these assets, because we brought it up to him, like, we can grab some of these and my friend can code something super quick. So we're like, yes, of course, let's nice do that.
We need we need another arcade style video game for the new, yeah, record.
Oh, yeah. We gotta be a, like, gallery up there.
We need a corner of our website where you can just go to play the arcade games, the companion, yeah, arcade games.
Yeah,
that'd, yeah, be sick. I mean, yeah, that's a great way to get people to the website, like, hang out, listen to some tunes.
How expensive do you think it is to make those, like, you know, those Game Boy looking ones that are like have emulators of like 100 games on them? You know,
oh, yeah. About?
I wonder how expensive it is to get something with that made with like the 8-bit video game sound versions of our new songs and like companion Howling Giant games. That's like the next level,
right,
merch package right there.
I mean, people are always coming up with like crazy merch ideas. Is like, people got toys and VHS tapes and like I've seen cereal boxes. Like, it's like, yeah, you could do whatever the fuck you want, right? Like,
that's right.
Who made the music for the Comet Rider 8-bit version? Did that, we just find that dude on like Fiverr?
I think it was
like
just somebody on Fiverr. It's like, I will, for $5, I will convert your track into little chiptune stuff. And did pretty good. For
it was not
bucks
perfect, yeah, but for $5, that was probably the best $5 we ever spent.
Yeah. Right.